is a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. We're here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. And how do we do that?
How do we get God back into the conversations of the day in ways that honor Jesus? How do we serve as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ and speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Let's face it, people don't need just another piece of our mind. What they need is the very piece of the mind of Christ. Now, how are we going to give that to them? Well, I invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, you can sign up for our email newsletter. You'll get lots of information and commentary we just don't have time to share here in this hour on the air. You could also like The Reconnect on Facebook and let us know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter, at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends, I have been maybe a little bit overwhelmed in the last week to 10 days in terms of stories related to friends at church or folks across the country who are dealing with either terminally ill children, terminally ill spouses, or parents. And so I just wanted to settle in here for a conversation with us at the outset of the hour, because I do think that there are times when we are surveying the news of the day and we are thinking about the challenges that we face either as a nation or even in our own lives, and we forget to count the blessings and we forget to recognize the joy. And I think that there are times that we think that we face greater difficulties or deeper struggles than can be endured. And so I just wanted to lift up a few stories today of families out there who may well be facing actually greater challenges than any of the rest of us. And so just put on your compassionate mindset here. Give yourself the liberty of having the mind of Christ in the matters of the day in relationship to the very real suffering that people are enduring. Now, I'm actually going to attempt in the first half of this show to talk about our neighbors who are Mormon, Roman Catholic, atheist, Muslim, and in every case, suffering. So let's see if I can accomplish all of that in our time together. This is off of the Washington Post Morning Mix, and the headline is Three Goodbyes in 3 Days, Why These Parents Watch Their Children Die at Home. It's by Lindsay Beaver, and you can read it online at the Washington Post. I'm just going to read a few of the paragraphs to you. Their children, Christopher 20, Elizabeth 19, and James 15, had been ravaged by a ruthless neurological disorder that over the years had stolen their ability to see, swallow, move, and remember. Life support was only then prolonging the inevitable. So this is going to be a pro-life conversation. This is going to be a conversation about what it means to be pro-life, even as parents who are religiously minded and desire to love their children from conception to natural death. What does that look like? What does it look like when the human body reaches the place where if we were to not force feed it, if we were to not do things that are dependent upon electricity to it, that the body would naturally pass from this life into the next? The obituary was a single notice cataloging all three deaths over 3 days. It was an unusual obituary, three siblings, three deaths on 3 days. It raised questions among those who knew nothing of the family's circumstances, but the local authorities had no reason to look into it, for they knew this to be an incomprehensible tragedy for a family with a genetic curse, nothing more. And here is, in terms of how we want to be praying for the Chapel family that live in Utah, they have a 10-year-old son whose name is Samuel, who has also been diagnosed with this fatal juvenile baton disease.
And so when we think about the reality that that these people are facing, we want to recognize that based on their Mormon faith, and their, when it talks about them quietly, constantly pleading for strength and comfort and peace and holding rightly to the belief that they will one day be reunited in heaven.
So that's going to be a conversation that as evangelical Christians we would certainly be engaging in if we were going to be talking with our Mormon neighbors about this particular subject. Now, it's notable that at the service
celebrating the life of these children, songs were sung that are going to sound quite familiar to you. Amazing Grace was sung, How Great Thou Art, I Know That My Redeemer Lives, which is based on a passage from the book of Job. Here's what I want us to understand about the very real struggle that families with terminally ill children are facing. These are parents who had lots of kids. They've actually got a total of 10 children. These three are their three oldest, and then they also have this 10-year-old Samuel who's also been diagnosed with this disease. And you say to yourself, okay, at some point, right? At some point, well, here's the challenge. All three of these children developed the symptoms related to this juvenile baton neurological disorder when between the ages of 5 and 10. And Miss Chapel was already pregnant with Samuel 10 years ago when her three eldest children were diagnosed. And so I want you to just imagine that, you know, for a number of years, you had healthy kids who were growing up and steadily moving along through all of the paces of development. And then you got this devastating diagnosis that not only was your child, or in this case, three of your children and eventually a fourth, were diagnosed with something that was going to take away their sight. It was eventually going to take away their ability to think. It was going to erase their memories. It was going to lead them erupting in episodes of anger and tears, and that they would slowly lose their ability not only to run, but eventually to walk, and finally even to crawl. The last thing to go after speech disappears is the ability to swallow. So you might imagine that after you cannot swallow anymore, parents have an unimaginable decision to make. Do we feed our children? Do we force feed our children via a feeding tube, or do we let death come naturally? Well, for a number of years, the Chappells did rely on feeding tubes, and then at the point when there's just no question that these three young teenagers older and younger teenagers were certainly going to die, they made the determination to no longer force feed them through a feeding tube and allow them to pass from this life into the next. I want to talk with you about that reality and about the hope that we have in Jesus Christ and about what it means to come alongside families with terminally ill children, particularly those who, when their child is diagnosed, you know, basically there is no medical hope. And we think to ourselves, well, that just never happens today. There's always medical hope. There's always something to do. There's always surgical intervention. There's always some kind of medication. There's always something to reverse the curse. And here's the reality. We're all going to die. We're all terminally ill. We don't know exactly, most of us don't know exactly what's going to kill us, but we do know that eventually, because of the consequences of sin, death is coming. And so for families, as they are enduring this process, let me invite you as a believer to just simply come alongside and be the witness to their pain, share their grief, walk with them in this long suffering. And this is probably just acutely real to me in this particular week, because as day school this semester in an adult class at our church, and we always open the time in prayer, and there's a lot of people in the class, and there are new people in the class virtually every week, and there were two young couples sitting on the right hand side of the class in the front row this week, and in the time when folks were asking for prayer, somebody else in the class said, well, I just want to acknowledge that this couple is here today. And we took note of it, but my husband did not put those pieces all together instantly to recognize that that's the young couple in our church whose five-year-old son, Job, died just a week ago. Was diagnosed with an inoperable terminal tumor in his brain less than a year ago, and now he's gone. Well, the passage that my husband was teaching on in Sunday school was the offering up of Samuel in sacrifice, of Isaac in sacrifice by Abraham, the Abraham's offering of
of Isaac on the altar. Now, I want you to just imagine as a Sunday school teacher that that's where the rubber's going to hit the road pretty quickly, as you have in your class a couple who indeed have walked that journey to return their child to the Lord, who has now called him home. So if you ever wanted to imagine what the show is seeking to equip you to do, we're actually seeking to equip you to be the eternal people of God in the midst of the everyday world where people are grieving and suffering, and children are dying. And so if you really wanted to know what's the show about, what does it look like to bring God back into the conversations of the day? It is about being God's redemptive people in a culture that is suffering and many people are without hope. So if you can be of encouragement today to another person in their experience in this life of suffering and grief and sorrow, and I can help you in doing that, then this will count this day a blessing. All right, turning from the realities that families are dealing with in terms of sick kids, let me lift up to you a story about the Pope. And you're saying to yourself, what? That's a horrible segue. It is a horrible segue, so let me just make it. This is a question of whether or not there's another Reformation underway. And this isn't just a Reformation among those of us who recognize that the Word of God needs to be restored to its rightful place in the life of the Protestant Church, because it certainly does. But there's actually an effort underway by dozens of conservative Roman Catholic priests and scholars who have accused the Pope of spreading heresy on moral issues, and on issues related to the Eucharist and on issues related to marriage. So the letter doesn't actually accuse the Pope himself of being a heretic, because I don't think among Catholics that would ever happen. But it does accuse the Pope of supporting, quote, heretical positions on marriage, the moral life, and the Eucharist. The Vatican has to this point declined to comment, which I'm probably not surprised by. This is actually the second time that a group of Catholics have issued a letter to the Pope. The first one was just last year. Four cardinals issued a dubia to the Pope, asking him to clarify some of the same points that are raised by these scholars and priests now in this more recent attempt to have the Pope answer questions about which he has created confusion among Catholics. So I'll just read a couple of lines from this report. The headline is from CNN. And church law, quote, church law itself requires that competent persons not remain silent when the pastors of the church are misleading the flock. So says this letter. And he says, specifically, the letter charges Francis with promoting seven heresies, most notably through his openness to allowing some divorced and remarried Catholics to receive Holy Communion. So therein lies the challenge, divorce and remarriage, and whether or not Catholics who are divorced and remarried should be allowed to partake of the Eucharist. Now, if this is not rubber that hits the road for you, your family's not big enough, or your family's unusual, because this is rubber that meets the road for a lot of people that I know who are Roman Catholic and for whom divorce and remarriage is certainly a reality. The conservative Catholics who issued this this letter to the Pope, accusing him of supporting heretical ideas, describe it as an epoch-making act with no precedent since 1333. Now, 1333 is the year in which Pope John the 22nd was rebuked for teaching that the souls of the dead did not see the face of God until the Last Judgment. So there you go. That's the last time that Catholics were apparently this agitated at one another in terms of what the Pope was saying about things and what conservative Catholics viewed about the same question. So here's how the article ends. It says, well, it's really hard to make a comparison between these two events from 1333 to 2017. Quote, 900 years ago, most Catholics were illiterate, and now everybody is on Twitter. Well, I'm not even sure that's an equivalent statement. The issue of illiteracy and the issue of being on Twitter, I don't know if you've been on Twitter lately, but there are a lot of illiterate people on Twitter. So I don't think you can make that. This is a question about whether or not Catholic doctrine aligns with Scripture. Okay? And that's ultimately the question you're going to have to ask yourself. What do the Scriptures say? What does God say about marriage and divorce, about divorce and remarriage? What does the Scripture say about who may or may not partake of the Lord's Supper? Because all of those things do not necessarily line up in the same way that either these conservative Catholic scholars and priests are saying, nor in the way the Pope has articulated. So there you go. The walk-off of the article is this. If you look at the pews and even at polls, most people like Pope Francis. They see in him a compassion they have not seen in the church and an understanding of the very difficult realities of living in the very complicated world. Okay, here's the challenge, friends. That is not the issue. The Pope's job is not to be the most well-liked guy in the world. The Pope's job is to represent Christ in the world today. And so certainly Christ is the God-man in whom compassion deeply dwells, but he's also perfectly holy, and he's not going to set aside his holiness in order for people to like him. It's just not going to happen. And he's not going to set aside his holiness in order to get people in the pews. Like, that's not Jesus' deal. So I think that just because this Pope is popular does not actually make him necessarily pious. And again, this is probably an argument better had among Catholics. And in fact, they're having it. But I think that we as observers of what's happening in Roman Catholicism ought to be paying attention to the fact that Catholics are certainly not all unified on the question of whether or not the things that the Pope has made recent statements about in terms of marriage, morality, and the Eucharist, they're not all on the same page about those things, which is curious because generally Catholics simply follow the lead of the Pope. And in this case, they're saying that the Pope is, in fact, in error. Okay, while we're talking about individuals and... Well, some people think, you know, the Pope sort of is actually the physical representation of Christ on the earth. So I will just use that as my segue into a conversation about North Korea, where some people think that their dictator possesses divinity. And so you're going to see lots of conversation in the news and the news media about whether or not we are escalating toward war with North Korea. North Korea accused us of actually declaring war. The president and his press secretary have certainly said, no, we certainly did not declare war. We have not declared war on North Korea. A declaration of war is actually only something Congress can enter into. And so the president can't do it in Twitter, nor during some escalating rhetoric on his own part. Our president is not practiced in the art of de-escalation. And certainly we are not going to expect a dictator in North Korea who thinks he is a deity, who thinks he is a god. We're certainly not going to expect him to de-escalate either. And so that leaves us at a very, very challenging impasse. It's very difficult for one who sees himself as more than human to reverse course or to back down, particularly to someone as human and viewed as such in terms of our president. So, you're going to see a lot of news related to that. And from a Christian worldview, the thing that you just need to keep pointing out is that we need to be ardently praying for the people of North Korea and the circumstances under which they live and what it must be like to live under a ruthless dictator who cares so little about his own people that he would starve them to death in order to continue to pursue his not only nuclear ambitions, but his ambition of being viewed as divine by others. So again, ardently, ardently praying for God to do something in relationship to North Korea and its precious people. While we're on the subject of North Korea, there is now a new travel ban that's been issued by the president. I will call this travel ban 3.0. You will remember that the travel ban as initially issued was a report. And so they made a new one. That one was also challenged in federal court. Now that travel ban 3.0 has been issued, the Supreme Court on Monday took a very unusual step. And the Supreme Court actually canceled oral arguments in relationship to President Trump's travel ban, which they were planning on talking about later this year. So the new broader travel ban does not only include Muslim majority countries. And so I think that the goal is here to insulate the president from charges that his actions are based on religious discrimination. And so now you, like me, are scrolling to like the fourth page of the article, where then you get to see what the list of countries what the list of countries includes. So the new executive order, in terms of a travel ban here to the United States, includes Iran, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Chad, North Korea, Iraq, and Venezuela. You're saying to yourself, Venezuela? I mean, isn't that just like our southern neighbor? It's just not very far from us. You're exactly right. But the current cultural mayhem in Venezuela and the socialist dictator means that our government is very uncomfortable in terms of the porous nature of Venezuela's borders and their ability to actually vet who is coming into and leaving their country. So like his first two travel bans, the president's latest restriction mostly targets predominantly Muslim countries, but obviously Venezuela is not nowhere near a predominantly Muslim country, and North Korea is officially an atheistic country or one that worships its own dictator. So with Venezuela and North Korea on the list, I think that the hope is that the charge of having a travel ban that is designed simply to keep one particular people group out in terms of religion, that charge won't stand. This all goes into effect on October the 18th. And I know you're wondering, how does it affect students? Basically students are going to be under the same rules as everybody else. And so if you are going to legitimately travel here as a student, I think you're going to be okay. With the exception of if you happen to be from North Korea, I don't think you're going to get to come either way. All right. So finally, before we go to the break, I have one more sort of sign of the times story for you. I found this fascinating. Maybe it will fascinate you as well. The first Muslim college in the United States has purchased a defunct Lutheran seminary in Berkeley, California. So Zaytuna College is the first accredited Muslim college in the United States. They paid $10 million for a 10-acre parcel of land that includes all kinds of buildings and dormitories. It used to be the Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary, now defunct, because, you know, Lutherans, particularly of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, so the ELCA variety of mainline Lutheranism, is dying on the vine. And so the ELCA sold this Christian seminary, which has been in operation for 64 years. Instead of selling it to maybe some other Christians, they sold it to a Muslim college in order that they can educate their students in Islamic law alongside courses in math and philosophy. So the seminary has been purchased by Zaytuna College. Now, notably, the Zaytuna College will also continue to own three buildings near the Graduate Theological Union, also in Berkeley, which is a consortium of what are called here research centers. It's actually a consortium of what you and I would have used to have called Christian seminaries, but they're just not anymore. They are a consortium of research centers that used to be Presbyterian and Episcopalian and Lutheran, and now are basically pursuing some sort of synthesis religion, I think is what I will call it, because they literally train people in basically a non-religious approach to some kind of humanistic fellowship. That's my best description of it. So the new campus of Zaytuna College, again, the first accredited Muslim college in the United States, has a Christian cathedral, which I full well expect them to no longer be using. All right, friends, that's about all I got for you in this first half of the program. The Reconnect is a listener-supported ministry by people just like you. We'd appreciate it if you took a minute and visited us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, you can support the ministry. You can download additional resources that are designed to help you reconnect the eternal with the everyday. You can order a copy of Speak the Truth, How to Bring God Back into Every Conversation. It is my new book, and it was just released yesterday. Hey, while you're at the website, you could become a reconnector. Reconnectors are our ministry. Hey friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about what people are talking about, and we're equipping you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of the world. We invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. So while you're at the website, sign up for our email list. You'll receive timely equipping resources designed to help you reconnect the eternal with the everyday and bring God back into the conversation in ways that honor Jesus. Again, the website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. All right, I'm excited to have with us here today Dr. Bruce Ashford. He has been with us on the Reconnect before. He's the provost and dean of the faculty at Southeastern Seminary. He's been teaching there since 2002 as a professor of theology and culture. He's a regular contributor to Fox News, the co-author of One Nation Under God, A Christian Hope for American Politics, and the author of Every Square Inch, An Introduction to Cultural Engagement for Christians. You can find him at bruceashford.net. You can follow him on Twitter at Bruce Ashford. Bruce, welcome back to The Reconnect.
Hey, great to be on the show, and congratulations on the book, Speak the Truth. Just got my copy in the mail.
Thank you. I look forward to not only you reading it, but getting your feedback on it. I would really value that.
Great. Looking forward to it.
All right. Let's start off our conversation today about one of the great challenges that we face in the culture. So you have written an Evangelical Conservative's Guide to Black Lives Matter. So what are the most important things for us to know, and how can we as conservative Christians evaluate the Black Lives Matter movement?
Yeah, you know, so I did a reader survey on my website to ask my readers what they wanted to hear from me. My readers on my website are mostly white and mostly political conservative, same as my readers on Fox News Opinion. And overwhelmingly, they wanted me to speak to the social and cultural movements that were race-related, alt-right, BLM, so forth. So that's why I did the series. And I think white conservatives especially, sometimes we're not on sure footing when we talk about race. So that was the purpose of the series, was to try to sort of accurately describe BLM and then to evaluate it. So let me give, if I can, kind of a quick nutshell, and then we can sort of click on the hyperlink and expand, so to speak, wherever you want to. So Black Lives Matter is a mixed bag. There are things that I want to affirm and things that I don't. Got its start in the wake of George Zimmerman's acquittal and then Michael Brown and Eric Garner's death. You had three LGBTQ activists who were black women who sort of started the Black Lives Matter movement to say that black lives matter. And if that's all that the movement were about, then I could be 100% behind it. Black lives do, in fact, matter every bit as much as any other life. But the movement quickly built into a more comprehensive political ideology. It is leans towards socialism in its economic platform. It is does not grow in the soil of the Christian church like the 1960 civil rights movement did. It's very distinctively not Christian. It's LGBTQIA activist group. It is affirming of intersectionality. We can talk about that if you want to in a minute. And so when it comes down to evaluating Black Lives Matter, do you want me to launch into an evaluation, a quick one?
Yeah, but you better define, at some point, we got to come back to intersectionality. So if you want to do those in either order you want, just tell us which order you're doing them in.
Okay, well, let's start with intersectionality. That's one of the frequently asked questions. So intersectionality is a pretty big deal. It was coined as a term, I think, in 1989 and has sort of gained popularity. And it's the academic theory that human identities are not singular. So my identity as a human being is a multi-layered identity. I'm a white man. I'm a middle-class man. I am a Christian man, etc. So it takes into account multiple layers: gender, race, social and economic class, nationality, sexual orientation, age, religion, etc. And it focuses on the way that a person's multiple identities can coalesce to make them a marginalized person. So a person is marginalized if they're a black man, but even more if they're a black woman. And then on top of that, if you're a black gay woman, then you're severely marginalized. So, and they would say that these identities coalesce to form a matrix of domination and oppression. What BLM ultimately wants to do is it wants a social revolution, not a reformation, not to reform what already exists, but to sort of clear the decks and start over again. And their vision for society, I would say, is very different from mine. And so while I can affirm that black lives do matter, I cannot affirm a lot of the other stuff that goes with BLM. You want me to give a quick evaluation?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So I divide my evaluation into three basic categories. The first is the near-term strategy. The near-term strategy of Black Lives Matter is to achieve justice and equality for black individuals and black communities. We can give a wholehearted yes to that. We may not approach it exactly the same way as some Black Lives Matter activists do, but we can affirm that we want to achieve justice and equality for the black community. So we need to learn to say that loudly and clearly. I think white conservatives especially need to say that loudly and clearly. We need to act to help make it happen. This is our moment. We shouldn't shift the blame, you know, change the subject, hem and haw, point out the negative aspects of the BLM movement. We need to learn to stand there and say what needs to be said. So that's near-term strategy, and we can, find some significant agreement there. Long-term strategy is a comprehensive, progressive social revolution, and this is where I don't agree with hardly anything that BLM is pushing for. Theirs is a movement towards affirming transgenderism as an ideology. They want to disrupt the nuclear family. That's a direct statement from the website.
Can I stop you there and ask a question? Mm-hmm. I have a hard time understanding how. And again, folks, we're talking to Bruce Ashford. And we're talking about, you know, some of the challenges that we face as conservative Christians in the culture today. And this conversation is in particular focused on Black Lives Matter. Bruce has an evaluation of the Black Lives Matter movement that I would recommend to you. You can find it at bruceashford.net. So that's the conversation that we're in the midst of. So when we talk about, let's say, affirming transgenderism, and if you are a Black Lives Matter activist and you are black, then being distinctively black is something that you do not actually think is malleable. You actually think that is an immutable characteristic, do you not? Or can anyone claim to be black? And so this is where I don't understand the alignment between transgenderism and something like something that is, well, frankly, I don't understand the alignment with feminism and transgenderism any more than I understand the alignment of Black Lives Matter with transgenderism. So can you help me understand that?
Yeah, I mean, there's an inconsistency there. And while they're trying to draw sort of a close analogy between race and sexual identity, it breaks down because it's not okay to claim a different race if I want to. I can't say, you know, I like to identify as a black man. The answer back would be, well, you're not a black man and you don't have the black experience. Yet on the other hand, it is okay for me to identify as a woman if I want to. So there's a real inconsistency there. There's also a real inconsistency between intersectionality and identity politics, because identity politics has always been premised upon one identity, the black identity or the gay identity. But with intersectionality, that means that you can't do that, because somebody who is black and gay can't lock arms exactly with someone who is black but not gay, especially if that person's a Bible-believing Christian and doesn't affirm homosexuality as a lifestyle. And so there's all sorts of internal contradictions here, which we would expect from an ideology that did not arise from Christian soil.
All right. So now, Professor, you may proceed with your analysis and evaluation of the long-term agenda of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Okay. So there's the comprehensive progressive social revolution affirms transgenderism as an ideology and wants a society to conform to it, same-sex marriage. They want to disrupt the Western nuclear family, they say on the website. And so there's just no way, there's no creative hermeneutic, there's no interpretive gymnastics we can do to affirm that this is any sort of a Christian reformation. It's not. Economically, it leans heavily socialist, which socialism is well-intentioned throughout history. Karl and Jenny Marx had the best of intentions. But socialism doesn't help doesn't cause society to flourish, and it doesn't really bring equality unless it's the kind of equality that a group of ships experience when they all sink together with the tide, because socialism harms economies in the long run. So that's long-term strategy, and I don't find much of anything I can agree with them on. Then you have their tactical approaches. You know, what are their tactics toward achieving their ends? And I've divided that into two categories. So first is nonviolent protest. So as best I can tell, no matter what your favorite news outlet tells you, because all of your news outlets tell partial truths, they're all in the service of an ideology, and so they tell partial truths. I don't think most of them can be trusted. But as best I can tell, most BLM activists prefer nonviolent direct action. So they don't want social passivity and quietness on the one hand. They don't want violence and militancy on the other. They want nonviolent direct action. Now, there are exceptions. There are BLM activists who are violent. Often they're not officially associated with BLM. They're just people holding BLM signs. But as best I can tell, nonviolent direct action is their preference, and if that's the case, you know, that is my strong preference. We don't want vigilante justice, and we don't want violence. But for those who are violent, I would go back to the Constitution and oppose them, that legislative, executive, and judicial figures, you know, are the ones who make law, enforce law, and interpret law. And I would go to the Bible, where God gives that right to the government. And then finally, in terms of tactical approach, their focus on law enforcement. Now, this is a mixed bag. BLM has focused its protests on instances in which we have captured on video black males being killed by white police officers. Now, unlike the civil rights movement, the civil rights movement was different, very different from BLM. It grew out of Christian soil. It had black male pastors as its leadership, for the most part. It had perfect victim cases like Rosa Parks. I mean, who's not going to stand up for Rosa Parks, a vulnerable woman on a bus?
Right.
And it had highly centralized leadership, and it was nonviolent. But BLM doesn't choose perfect victim cases. They choose cases that are much less clearly defined. We have a black man being killed on video by police officers, and it looks like an absolute injustice, and maybe. But you don't know because you don't know context. And so I think we're going to have to reserve judgment. And so if BLM says that a police officer cannot be sheriff, judge, and jury for a black male on the streets, they're exactly right. But also, we on television, viewing the television, can't be sheriff, judge, and jury of that police officer because we don't know context. So how do we respond? One is, I would say, we need to weep with those who weep. One of the problems, I think, white people tend not to have black friends, tend not to have black families mm-hmm. into our home, and so we don't understand, we haven't opened ourselves up to the black experience. We don't know how to weep with those who weep. You got 1 minute for me to read a little paragraph from Micah Edmondson?
Sure.
Yeah, so Pastor Micah Edmondson, he's a black man, PhD in systematic theology, Presbyterian pastor. Here's what he says. My wife has to beg me, a grown man, 40 years old or so, not to go out to Walmart at night, not because she's afraid of the criminal element, but because she's afraid of the police. She knows that when the police see me, they're not going to see Micah Edmondson, pastor. When they see me, they're not going to see Micah Edmondson, PhD in systematic theology. When they see me, they're just going to see a black man out late at night. And she knows that we're getting stopped at 10 times the rate, arrested at 26 times the rate, killed at 5 times the rate. BLM is pointing to those statistics. And why is it that BLM sees the value of black life better than Christians seem to? Why do they care more about the value of my life than Christians often seem to? So I do think there's a way that we can weep with those who weep without at the same time casting judgment on a police officer when we don't know in the end whether or not the violence was just or unjust. So that would be the second point. In addition to weeping with those who weep, let's refuse to play judge and jury. And then third, push for institutional reform where it's needed. So if and where there is a law enforcement culture that is tilted and slanted against black people in a way that's unjust, and surely there are instances like that in law enforcement departments like that, then in those cases, let's push for change. But let's also not stereotype police officers. Seems to me most of them are doing their very best to protect our communities. So that's a,
all right. That is Bruce
evaluation.
Yeah, let me just remind people that you are hearing Bruce Ashford. He's the provost and dean of the faculty at Southeastern Seminary. You can actually find what we're talking about, which is an Evangelical Conservative's Guide to hashtag Black Lives Matter, at bruceashford.net. And Bruce, I do want to segue into maybe at this point the briefest of conversations about the very cool new ebook that you and your wife have written. But I don't want to jump away from this conversation without reminding my listeners that, hey, we have talked about this on this program, the Black Lives Matter movement, and the issues and the concerns related to it. With African-American pastors, we have talked about this issue with Senator Tim Scott. And I want to wholeheartedly recognize our responsibility as white Christians to refuse to be silent on issues of injustice wherever we experience them and see them and recognize them, and not close our eyes and become unnecessarily defensive in relationship to the experience of other people. And so let me affirm that as we transition from this conversation, Bruce, to a conversation about making our holidays holy again, because this is gonna seem like a crazy segue for my listeners. So friends, if you're listening, just act like I'm now interviewing somebody else. And let me just reintroduce my friend and colleague, Bruce Ashford, because this ebook that you and Lauren have written about every holiday a holy day. First of all, friends, it's free. The holidays are coming up. And this is an ebook that we just want to lift up and celebrate to you. So let's talk about every holiday a holy day. Why do people need this?
Yeah, so you know, Lauren and I are parents of small children, and we were really excited. One of the editors at Fox News approached us and asked us if we'd be willing to write some brief opinion pieces for them in the annual holiday cycle that taught sort of how to teach your children about the gospel and holidays. And it's really true that small children they love holidays, and their little ears are turned on and their hearts are open during the holidays. And so Lauren and I, just for a series of articles, not only with Fox but at my website and then some extra articles for this book, we just put together sort of a guide to many of the holidays each year and showed how we can frame each of those holidays in light of the Christian gospel, and how we can teach our children and teach our children to even be a witness during the holidays. So we cover anything from the Super Bowl to Christmas, New Year's, Thanksgiving, Father's Day, Mother's Day, and so forth. It was a fun little book. It's, I don't know, maybe 50 pages, quick read, and we hope it'll help some other parents who, like us, have small children and want to leverage the holiday to teach their children about Christ.
I love it. So friends, it is every holiday a holy day. You can get it at, you can get the link to it at bruceashford.net. That's probably the easiest place to send people to get it. It's technically on Southeastern Seminary's Intersect Project website, but they're all linked together because, you know, they're all a big hive of activity up there. So if you can get to one of those websites, you can find this. It's Every Holiday a Holy Day, and it's a free ebook from Bruce and Lauren Ashford, and I want to recommend it to you if you are the parents of small children and you're looking for a way to, you know, to not only help get God back into the conversations around the holiday table, but actually get the gospel back into your home on every holiday. Hey, Bruce, thank you so much for joining us today again on The Reconnect, and blessings upon you.
Thanks a lot, Carmen. It's been great to be on the show, and congratulations on your new book, Speak the Truth.
Thank you, sir. All right, friends, I'm going to do a quick, super quick below the fold today, because some of you have complained that I dogged out on you a couple of times and I ran these interviews too long and you didn't get a below the fold, and you've been, I have heard your hot breath across the airwaves. So here we go. Does a river have human rights? This is the below the fold for the day today. Environmentalists are suing to give human rights to a river. Now, some of you are not only rolling your eyes, there are guttural noises coming out in relationship to my announcing this, because you recognize that We have talked here on the Reconnect about efforts in the courts to appeal for the human rights of animals, to extend human rights to animals. In particular, there's a chimpanzee and there's a baboon. There are other primates for whom human rights have been argued. Well, now an environmental group has filed the first lawsuit of its kind in the United States, attempting to force the state of Colorado to recognize the legal rights of the Colorado River and its surrounding ecosystem. Quote, this action comes as courts around the world are beginning to hold that nature and ecosystems possess legally enforceable rights. So says the CELDF's International Center for the Rights of Nature. So I'm just letting you know right now, there's a Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF, that has a center for the rights of nature. Now, I got to tell you, we got human rights issues all over the world. We have people in desperate, dire need all over the world. And we have people who apparently have so much money to burn and so many law degrees that comes into the piled higher and deeper. Not everybody with a PhD is using it for good. Some of them are just piling it higher and deeper out here. Okay, so this is what's going on. It's going on in Colorado. Here is, again, what the director of the Center for the Rights of Nature at the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund had to say. Building on ongoing lawmaking efforts. Now, that is in reference to those court cases related to extending human rights to animals. So she says, building on ongoing lawmaking efforts, we believe that this lawsuit will be the first of many, which begins to change the status of nature under our legal systems. The organization wants society to revert to, quote, a sustainable culture without the modern form of civilization, which they say is fueled by limited resources that ought to be left alone. Quote, life on Earth is more important than this insane temporary culture based on hyper-exploitation of finite resources. This culture, she says, needs to be destroyed before it consumes all life on the planet. Humanity is not the same as civilization, so says the group's website. Humans have developed many sane and sustainable cultures themselves, now at risk from civilization. Okay, first of all, that's nonsense. But second of all, I would like for you to ask the people of Puerto Rico whether or not they want their power infrastructure restored, and whether or not they want potable water, and whether or not they want the people who have been on dialysis to simply be allowed to now die, because those dialysis machines can't run without electricity, which this organization says is a part of this non-sustainable civilization, this industrial civilization that is dependent on fossil fuels for the production of electricity. Of finite resources. I want these people to be sent to Puerto Rico. I want to send these people from Colorado to Puerto Rico. And I want them to experience what it's like to try to live without power. Because that's what they want. They want us to, quote, return to what culture was like, what life was like when it was sustainable. Okay, what they're talking about there is subsistence living. Subsistence living. We're talking about the Middle Ages. I don't want to go back there. If the people of Colorado want to go back there, you probably discern what I have to say about that. All right, friends, that's all we got time for today here on The Reconnect. You can connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast, donate to the ministry, share today's show with someone new. Have a great day. I'll see you right back here tomorrow. God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.